Welcome to the Christian Science Monitor. I'm Philip Moore for Radio Reading Services. This week I'm reading from the March 25th, 2019 edition of the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. The cover story for this issue, The Independent Mystique, Why Republicans and Democrats Don't Have to Worry About a Third-Party Candidate Capturing the Presidency in 2020. The article is by Peter Greer of the Christian Science Monitor. Before we delve into the main article, here is an introductory article by editor Mark Sappenfield, which provides some background and context for the main article. Editor Sappenfield's headline, A Democracy Without Guardrails. When the American founders established the republic, did they equip it with training wheels or guardrails? It is safe to say that when the United States became independent, there was the very real chance that it might fail. Beyond the lingering threat of the British and the divisions between states' rights and federalism, there was an altogether more immediate peril: the people themselves. Yes, America was perhaps the world's grandest experiment in individual liberty and self-government, but the founders were deeply worried that the people could ruin everything too. So they hedged their bets. They hemmed in the power of the popularly elected House of Representatives with the Senate, which was elected by state legislators. They gave a class of elite electors the ability to overrule the voters through the Electoral College. That was a key theme in the development of American democracy. People ultimately had the power, but in many cases, they didn't wield it directly. There were buffers to temper the voice of the people and make decisions on their behalf. This became the case in other parts of American politics, too. Take presidential primaries or the basic act of legislating. The classic smoke-filled rooms are how politicians chose presidential nominees or made compromises, very intentionally away from public eyes. Those buffers of American democracy are now almost completely gone. Were they the training wheels that helped us get going, or were they guardrails that protected us from ourselves? At every turn, American democracy is becoming more direct. The popular election of the Senate is only the most obvious example. More deeply, American voters are no longer sending legislators to Washington to represent them. They are sending them to Washington with marching orders, and they are following every key vote on blogs and cable television. Voters are taking control. This is true across the political spectrum. In his cover story this week, staff writer Peter Greer shows dramatically how the power of one of those traditional buffers, political parties, has decayed. Parties used to be able to set policy, discipline members, and maintain rigid control. In the last presidential election, how well did the parties control Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders? This is a natural development. Democracies tend to become more direct over time. After all, voters want to have more power, not less. But with this realization comes another. The Washington of today is more directly our creation. We hold the power. After the 2012 election, for example, Republican Party leadership backed immigration reform. But Republican voters would have none of it. The voters set the agenda and voted in the president they wanted. The same trend is now happening among Democrats, reshaping policy around economics, race, and justice. This is not inherently good or bad. It just means that, more than ever, the finger of responsibility is now pointing back at us. Editor Mark Sappenfield can be reached at his email address, editor, E-D-I-T-O-R, at csmonitor.com. Now for this week's cover story by Peter Greer. It begins with this headline, Party Lines. Why Republicans and Democrats Don't Have to Worry About a Third-Party Candidate Becoming President. Washington. Academics who studied the problem were worried, so they organized a group of top-shelf professors to study the issues and recommend ways the U.S. could improve Washington's performance. Their conclusion: the Republican and Democratic parties were disorganized and needed to get their act together. Local and state organizations dominated, while the national teams had little unity and less ability to shape a program and get it through Congress. Their solution: the parties needed to polarize themselves, with the Democrats becoming more uniformly liberal and the Republicans thoroughly conservative. That way, issues could be sharpened and voters could have a clear choice. The parties needed, quote, sufficient internal cohesion, end quote, and a degree of unity, also in quotes, they lacked, concluded the report of the American Political Science Association, the APSA. As you might imagine, this study wasn't issued any time in the recent past. Titled Toward a More Responsible Two-Party System, it came out in 1950. Back then, party identity had mushy aspects. There were lots of liberal Republicans, more from the Northeast, and even more conservative Democrats, mainly in the South. Internal divisions made it hard for the parties to push through solutions to the policy issues of the post-World War II world. Polarization would produce more effective government, in the association's view. How's that working? 70-odd years later, the Democratic and Republican parties are among the most disliked institutions in America. They're polarized, all right, but are they effective? Most voters might say not so much. America's two-party system is broken. That's what former Starbucks CEO Howard Schultz says, anyway. The self-described centrist and possible candidate for president has made criticism of the Republican and Democratic parties the central theme of his as-yet unofficial campaign. Both parties today are on the far left and far right, are more interested in partisan politics, revenge politics, says Mr. Schultz in a CNN town hall broadcast on February 12th. I think we could be doing much better. That's a quote from Mr. Schultz. The article continues. Voters are tired of the bickering and gridlock and policy problems left unsolved. Their trust in the parties as institutions is down there with phone companies, Congress, and the media. The percentage of citizens who register as independent rather than Democrat or Republican is at an all-time high. But what if the parties are the solution as much as the cause for the nation's malfunctioning political system? After all, political scientists and other experts view them as an indispensable organizers of democracy. In this view, the party's real problem is weakness, not strength. Electoral reforms have hurt their organizational cohesion. Outside money has weakened their hold on elected officials, and partisan media has diluted their ability to define their own policies and positions. At the same time, the parties as ideas are as strong and partisan as ever. Decades of ideological sorting have produced clear left-right blue-red teams. Like rival teams everywhere, the members are ready to fight no matter what their nominal party leaders want to do. In U.S. politics, the defining characteristic of our age is that the parties are weak, but partisanship is strong, according to Julia Azari, a political scientist at Marquette University in Milwaukee. That's a dangerous combination. It risks unmediated political combat that could damage the idea of legitimate opposition. The solution might lie not in attacking the parties from without and replacing them with a third party, as Mr. Schultz would do, but rebuilding and modifying them from within. The norms that we depend on to keep democracy functioning aren't just there or not. They are enforced by political actors, and parties play an important role in that enforcement, wrote Dr. Azari in 2016 in an analysis on the blog Mischiefs of Faction. We'll get back to Mr. Schultz and his independent presidential ambitions in a bit. First, let's consider why the U.S. has political parties at all. They weren't part of the original plan. There's no mention of parties in the Constitution's elaborate scheme of branches of government with interlocking and balancing powers. Many of the founding fathers were suspicious of political organizations. James Madison warned of the mischiefs of faction in Federalist Paper Number 10. But when new Treasury Secretary Alexander Hamilton decided to push controversial plans such as repayment of state war debts and creation of a national bank, he reached out to like-minded business leaders and nationalist-minded citizens to form a supportive network. Almost inevitably, this solidified into a party in favor of a strong centralized government, the Federalist Party. Its success in the 1790s produced a rival organization and political leaders who favored a smaller federal role in U.S. life, such as Madison and Thomas Jefferson, coalesced into the Democratic Republican Party. These parties began selecting candidates for office, guiding voters at polling places on election day, and in general organizing the machinery of American democracy. The two big parties of today aren't literal descendants of those ancestors. There have been organizational twists, implosions, and reversals along the way, but they're constructed on the framework established more than 220 years ago. Parties in the 21st century have expanded their scope of operation, of course. They still vet and select candidates, but they also raise money, emphasize and frame issues, pitch their views to the public, and more. Defined in their largest sense, parties today also include interest groups, lobbyists, factional organizations such as the Freedom Caucus, and partisan media. Perhaps most important, they serve as brands to help people sort through ideas. Politics is complicated. Issues are numerous. Normal life is demanding. Who can be an expert on mayoral politics and state issues, as well as the whole range of national questions from taxes to foreign policy? Party brands are a shortcut. They serve as a general indication of what voters should think about particular candidates or proposed solutions to issues. Americans do not have time to sit there reading an entire candidate's platform, so the parties perform an important function in serving as this heuristic, says Samara Klar, an associate professor of political science at the University of Arizona in Tucson, and a scholar of individuals' political identities and behavior. This is the system Mr. Schultz and his advisors want to blow up. They describe the Republican and Democratic parties as increasingly extreme, migrating to the far right and far left of the political spectrum, respectively. In such a situation, what should a poor centrist do? Are we fated to be in this duopoly in perpetuity? Said Schultz advisor Steve Schmidt. Well, maybe not these two parties in this form. Throughout U.S. history, the two parties that compete to run the country have changed, combined, and split, swapped places, and died and were reborn. The period prior to the Civil War is notable in this regard. The Whig Party went under to be replaced in large part by the new Republican Party. The Democratic Party split, with slavery as the wedge. Some Democrats, notably Northerners, stayed loyal to the Union. Some, notably Southerners, became Confederates. But the machinery of the U.S. electoral system just isn't set up to encourage multiple-party presidential bids. For one thing, the winner-take-all nature of almost all U.S. elections herds voters into two parties. Diverger's Law, named for the late French scholar Maurice Diverger, or Diverger, D-U-V-E-R-G-E-R, posits that electoral systems where individual races are decided in favor of whomever has the most votes inevitably produce two-party coalitions. That's because citizens are loath to waste votes on candidates with no hope of winning. Nor is there a big effort or big enough pool of persuadable independent voters that a third-party candidate could tap for support. True, independent is a category in many major political polls. And surveys indicate that 30-40% of Americans now describe themselves as independents. But political scientists long ago determined that most of these voters are closet partisans. About one-third of independents vote no differently than committed Republicans, and a similar percentage are Democrats in all but name. The remaining slice, representing about 10% of the U.S. electorate, is truly independent. Generally speaking, these are the least engaged citizens in the country, with below average interest in political issues and the lowest propensity to vote. Dr. Klar, her last name, by the way, is spelled K-L-A-R, co-author of Independent Politics, How American Disdain for Parties Leads to Political Inaction, says her research shows that voters who decline to identify as Democrat or Republican disproportionately don't want to talk about politics or do anything that betrays their independence, like post a lawn sign. Labeling oneself as an independent, quote, is a social presentation, Dr. Klar says. It's a frame that people like to use. For these reasons and more, the U.S. remains largely a two-party country. It's been more than 50 years since a third-party candidate won a state in a presidential election. That was George Wallace, who in 1968 won 5 states and 46 electoral college votes. But third-party candidates have swung elections to someone else. Former President Teddy Roosevelt, running as the choice of the Bull Moose Party, drew votes from GOP President William Howard Taft and helped put Democrat Woodrow Wilson in the White House. Some Democrats still blame consumer advocate Ralph Nader's run as a Green Party candidate in 2000 for Republican George W. Bush's razor-thin 2000 election over Democrat Al Gore. This doesn't mean a Schultz win is impossible. Donald Trump's unexpected victory in 2016 has taught a generation of pundits never to dismiss possibilities just because they are outside their normal frame of reference. Many American voters don't yet have any idea who Mr. Schultz is. 46% of respondents to an early February CNN poll said they had never heard of the coffee entrepreneur. Still, Mr. Schultz's early numbers are brutal. The same CNN poll found only 4% of voters said they were very likely to back him, and that number was steady across Democrats, Republicans, and independents alike. he appears to have no natural base of support. Mr. Schultz would have been better off running as an independent voice within a party, says Dr. Klar. In essence, that's what Mr. Trump and then independent Senator Bernie Sanders did in the 2016 campaign. Neither seemed beholden to the party orthodoxy. At times, they appeared to be running against the leaders of the Republican and Democratic parties, respectively. There's also the approach Barack Obama took in 2008 to set himself off as an independent voice. He talked about a different kind of politics, how the country needed to come together more than the traditional policy and party issues. If you ID yourself as a post-partisan candidate within a party, you can have this image of being an outsider, non-establishment type, says Dr. Klar. But the success outsiders such as Mr. Trump and Senator Sanders inside the system may be a sign of trouble in the modern U.S. party structure. It could mean the ability of party leaders to police renegade political behavior is declining. One of the fundamental purposes of a political party is to serve as a gatekeeper for potential candidates. To the extent the party is unable to do this, it erodes the organization's ability to shape its identity. Democratic Party leaders squashed a fast-rising Henry Ford for the President movement in 1923. For instance, Ford was a violent anti-Semite, They moved to marginalize segregationist George Wallace within the party, forcing him into an independent presidential bid in 1968. The importance of backroom deals and party bosses has been undercut by the rise of binding primaries and post-Watergate party reforms, however. The good news is that's made candidates more reflective of voter choice. That's the bad news, too. The Founding Fathers worried about the possibility of demagogues and the fickleness of popular choice. Binding primaries were certainly more democratic, but might they be too democratic, right? Harvard professors of government Stephen Levitsky and Daniel Ziblatt, in their book, How Democracies Die. Today, the ability of party establishments to act as gatekeepers appears to have ebbed. In decades past, when Mr. Sanders, a self-declared independent, have come as close to winning the Democratic nomination as he did in 2016, would Mr. Trump have been shut out of Republican consideration altogether? Many GOP leaders didn't want him to win. By the time they recognized the threat he posed to them, it was too late. Meanwhile, the definition of party is broadening in modern America with the rise of partisan interest groups, lobbyists, and right and left-leaning media organizations. The Democratic and Republican parties today are not hierarchical quasi-tribal groups as much as conglomerate blobs. At the same time, the party structures have become as polarized as they've ever been. Democrats and Republicans used to be big tent coalitions with substantial members of moderates in both. But a fundamental transformation began in the 1960s, is now virtually complete. Southern Dixiecrat Democrats are today almost all Republicans. Rockefeller Republicans are Democrats or powerless members of the GOP. This polarization didn't come about by accident. It was a deliberate process pushed by activists, politicians, and experts across the political spectrum, says Sam Rosenfield, an assistant professor of political science at Colgate University in Hamilton, New York, and author of The Polarizers, Postwar Architects of Our Partisan Era, the American Political Science Association report, in a 1950. The Polarizers, Postwar Architects of Our Partisan Era, period. The next sentence. The American Political Science Association report in 1950 was part of the push. But there were some important flaws in the polarization rationale. Those who thought it was a good idea didn't foresee how often government power would be divided in the future, with only one party holding the White House and another Congress, or at least one congressional branch. Supporters thought polarized parties would be more likely to produce unified parliamentary-style efficient government. Instead, the U.S. has too often faced gridlock, brinkmanship, and chaos. Neither did they appreciate how powerful party identity would become in a polarized era. Republicans and Democrats are increasingly culturally, socially, and racially distinct. The GOP is predominantly white and Christian. The Democratic Party is largely a coalition of minorities and some whites with college degrees. That's a recipe for each side to see members of the competing party as the other, people you don't want to talk to or live with, a separate tribe. A benefit of that old system was a kind of basic level of functionality of governing, says Dr. Rosenfeld. Today's polarized system has a brittleness to it, a tendency toward grinding dysfunction and systemic crisis that is a real problem. This is the situation that Marquette's Dr. Azari defines as weak parties and strong partisanship. Party organizations don't have any real power over office holders or candidates. Meanwhile, the rank and file is eager to defend itself against those people on the other side of the ideological divide. The result is a decaying sense of legitimate opposition, or the realization that the opposing party will win one day in a continuing cycle of exchange control. The chance of "lock her up" at Trump rallies in 2016, referring to Hillary Clinton, were good examples of the erosion of the view of legitimate opposition. In 2020, who thinks there won't be "lock him up" chants at some Democratic events? Colgate's Dr. Rosenfeld prefers, quote, "hollow" to "weak" when discussing the state of party organizations. Party structures in Congress remain quite effective, he points out. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, in their own ways, have both proved this point. At the national level, the parties remain skilled at raising money, but at the state and local levels, they're far more vital institutions they used to be. Improving U.S. governments in today's polarized world might involve reducing the ability of individuals or small groups to exercise veto power and bring normal operations to a halt, Dr. Rosenfeld says. In Congress, that could mean getting rid of filibusters, or the need to vote to raise the debt limit, or vote to keep the government open. Getting rid of supermajority requirements like the filibuster would not be a solution to polarization, but it would allow for a single party, when it had power, to do more, he says. It's also true that viewing the state of U.S. political parties in 2019 in the broader context of U.S. history can make the current state of affairs seem less fraught, if not exactly stable. Mr. Schultz, for example, insists that both parties are moving toward the extremes of their respective ends of the political spectrum. He'll offer a centrist choice, he says, more comfortable to voters. But extremism is in the eye of the beholder. Polarized politics has come and gone in the U.S. over the years, notes Simon Gilhooly, an assistant professor of political and American studies at Bard College in Annandale on Hudson, New York. Trump's anti-immigrant rhetoric, disparagement of minorities, and anti-intellectualism are all long-standing elements of U.S. politics, says Dr. Gilhooly. At one point, socialism was, too. Between 1900 and 1915, 140 towns in America elected a socialist mayor, according to Dr. Gilhooly. Oklahoma was a very vibrant area for American socialism, he says. an expansive political spectrum, has a storied history in the United States. To some extent, today's ideological transformation of party politics, with the GOP moving right toward Trumpian populism and Democrats shifting left toward Elizabeth Warren and Mr. Sanders, could be seen as a return to the future. As the parties have become more sorted and polarized, the candidates that appeal to the base in both parties are moving away from the center to try to secure nominations, Dr. Gilhooly says. In that sense, the period following World War II might be the real anomaly, a time of relative centrism and overlapping parties driven by the need to stand together against the perceived existential threat of Cold War communism. Today's robust debates about things as far apart as Medicare for All and the wall might just be a reflection of the true American political ethos. That concludes our time together and the article for this week. I'm Philip Moore for Radio Reading Services. Thanks for joining me.